From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, noted author Robert Zimmerman joins us. All things space, but here's what's happening. Well, as we know now, 40 years ago, July 20th, 1969, two Americans, Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, landed on the moon. A moment that will stand forever in time as one of humanity's most remarkable achievements. But the stage was set in this 1962 speech given at Rice University in Houston, Texas. President John F. Kennedy reaffirmed America's commitment to landing a man on the moon before the end of the 1960s. The president spoke in philosophical terms about the need to solve the mysteries of space and also defended the enormous expense of the space program.
There is no strife, no prejudice, no national conflict in outer space as yet. Its hazards are hostile to us all. Its conquest deserves the best of all mankind. And its opportunity for peaceful cooperation may never come again. But why, some say, the moon? Why choose this as our goal? And they may well ask, why climb the highest mountain? Why, 35 years ago, fly the Atlantic? Why does Rice play Texas? We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
I still get chills listening to that. So at 4:17 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time on July 20th, 1969, the Eagle lunar lander carrying Commander Neil Armstrong and lunar module pilot Buzz Aldrin touched down in the Sea of Tranquility.
Contact right. Okay, engine stop. Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Apollo 14 astronaut Edgar Mitchell, the sixth man to walk on the moon, is with us for a moment now. Edgar, welcome back to Coast, and thank you for coming on tonight.
Well, thank you, George. Good to talk to you.
A tremendous, momentous occasion. Hard to believe, Edgar. 40 years now. 40 years. Can you believe it?
Well, I'll have to admit, it seems like a short time, but it's been a long time, and I'm glad we're here.
You went through a couple tense moments yourself on Apollo 14. There was one case where the computer was malfunctioning. They had some software problems, and you had to manually enter changes, what, over 80 different keystrokes on the computer pad?
Yes, that was in the short time before we landed on the last pass, before we started down. It was kind of a make-or-break moment.
And then on the second problem, as the altimeter failed as well, you and Alan Shepard had just a few moments to decide, let's do it. And he took it in manually, didn't he?
Yeah, we knew what had to be done. It had to be reactivated the landing radar at a very crucial time. And we had very little time to do it, but they made the right call at the ground. We did it, and it all worked.
Was there a time, Edgar, that you and Alan were looking at each other while all this was going on? And I know you don't have a lot of time to talk about what's happening while you're both in that capsule, but did you say anything to each other?
No, as a matter of fact, we didn't. We knew what was going, what had to be done. We'd simulated things like this, not this particular situation, but things like this over and over again. It was another one of those what-if problems. And since the lunar module was my job, I knew it like the back of my hand. I knew there were two things to do, and it was a matter of which one Houston was going to call that was due, either reset the circuit breaker or recycle the switch. And they chose reset the circuit breaker, and that was on Alan's side of the cockpit, so they called that, and it worked, and we were on our way.
Edgar, the three Apollo astronauts today told President Obama, let's go to Mars, and I am sure you would agree with that.
Well, I agree we will in due course. I think we need to regain some momentum. I think we need to get our feet. We've lost a lot of people. We've lost a lot of talent. maybe going back to the moon and giving our building up our confidence, building up our team again, maybe first. But we'll get to Mars in due course, I'm sure.
Thank you, Edgar. The best to you and your family, my friend.
Thank you.
Edgar Mitchell. I sat next to him. I had dinner in Washington, D.C. at Stephen Bassett's X conference, and just a wonderful individual. And that's where he confided that he'd love to go back up if he could. That would make him the oldest man ever to go back into space. Dramatic and previously unheard recordings of the moment the Russians tried to gate crash the American moon landing in 1969 have just been released by the University of Manchester Center for Astrophysics in the UK. The recordings were made in the control room of the famous Jodrell Bank Observatory, where astronomer Sir Bernard Lovell and colleagues were listening to transmissions from the moon. In July of 1969, the telescopes there were tracking the American's Eagle lander carrying the astronauts onto the surface of the moon. At the same time, scientists were also tracking the unmanned Soviet spacecraft Luna 15, which was trying to land on the moon, collect samples of the lunar soil and then rock, and then return to Earth to scoop the U.S. Apollo 11 mission. The data captured by the Lovell radio telescope revealed that this rocket orbited the moon, crash-landed onto its surface at 1550 on the 21st of July, just a few hours before the Americans lifted off the moon's surface. But for a while, the Brits thought that the Russians had successfully landed.
Well, that we believe to have been the landing of Luna 15, and here in the background, you'll hear the voices of the Apollo astronauts on the moon. We think that the landing is taking place in the Sea of Fertility, as close to the Sea of Tranquility.
So it was just an amazing moment, that very old audio tape, 40 years old. Sir Bernard Lovell, the founder of the observatory and the man behind the famous Lovell radio telescope, can be heard narrating those events in transmissions. So the Russians tried to scoop us, but they did not. The bathroom lines at the already crowded space shuttle and space station complex got a little longer over the weekend because of a flooded toilet. One of the two commodes aboard the International Space Station broke down right in the middle of the complicated robotic work being conducted by two crew members. The pump separator apparently flooded. Mission Control advised the astronauts to hang an out-of-service sign on the toilet until it could be fixed. In the meantime, the six space station residents had to get in line to use their one good toilet, and Endeavour's seven astronauts were restricted to the space shuttle bathroom. There have never been so many people, 13, together in space. And scientists have found evidence that another object has bombarded Jupiter exactly 15 years after the first impacts by the comet Shoemaker-Levy 9, following up on a tip by an amateur astronomer that a new dark scar had suddenly appeared on Jupiter. Scientists at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, using NASA's infrared telescope facility at the summit in Hawaii, gathered enough evidence indicating an impact. New infrared images show that the likely impact point was near the South Polar region, with a visible dark scar and bright upwelling particles in the upper atmosphere detected in the near-infrared wavelengths, and a warming of the upper troposphere with possible extra emission from ammonia gas detected at the mid-infrared wavelengths. Shoemaker-Levy 9 was a comet that had been seen to break into many pieces before the pieces hit Jupiter in 1994. Space rocks that slammed into the glaciers of eastern Canada some 12,900 years ago likely helped wipe out mega animals like the woolly mammoths and possibly the continent's first human inhabitants called the Clovis people, according to a new study. Evidence comes from recently discovered nano-sized diamonds, which researchers say are the strongest clues to date for an argument that could explain the region's die-off. To date, two major explanations, human overhunting and climate change, but they said that those two together were insufficient to account for the mega die-off. Now with the comet impact, they say we've got the three factors. Indian astrologers are predicting violence and turmoil across the world as a result of this week's total solar eclipse, with the superstitious and some religious viewing this as a sign of doom. But astronomers and scientists are trying to downplay these claims of evil portent in connection with Wednesday's natural spectacle when the moon will come between the Earth and the sun, completely obscuring the sun. In Hindu mythology, two demons, Rahu and Ketu, are said to swallow the sun during eclipses, snuffing out its life-giving light and causing food to become uneatable and water undrinkable. Pregnant women are advised to stay indoors, this is according to their mythology, to prevent their babies developing birth defects, while prayers, fasting, and ritual bathing, particularly in holy rivers, are encouraged. Southwest Airlines says an Arizona man was stung by a scorpion that hitched a ride in his carry-on luggage and delivered its sting just before his flight landed. Later on, they found that scorpion and five baby scorpions. They got them all. This guy was treated. He's okay. Defense Secretary Robert Gates plans to increase the size of the U.S. Army by 22,000 troops. A Texas airman stationed at an Air Force base near Sacramento, California, has lost both legs after surgeons botched a routine surgery to remove his gallbladder. The 20-year-old Colton Reed underwent surgery last week. It was just for a minimally invasive procedure that involves just making a tiny incision to minimize pain and speed his recovery. Something went wrong. They mistakenly cut his aortic valve, which supplies blood to the heart, and then he ended up losing both legs as a result of loss of blood. The Beastie Boys album and summer tour, they've been postponed after band member Adam Yauch discovered that he is suffering from cancer. In a posting on the band's website, he reveals a cancerous tumor in one of his glands, and he will need surgery. He is expected to fully recover. The total price tag for federal support stemming from the financial crisis could reach $23.7 trillion in the long run, according to the government's top bailout watchdog, saying in a new report that will be delivered to Congress tomorrow. Catherine Austin Fitz, I remember you and Gerald Celente said, it's not going to be $700 billion, it's going to be trillions, and here it is.
Yes. Now, he's counting both Fed and Treasury assistance, so it's not just the TARP program. It's all the bailouts collectively, both Fed and Treasury. Now, but I also have to say, George, you look at this guy. He's young. He's never served as an inspector general before. He's a U.S. assistant attorney. Mm-hmm. So I'm a little bit skeptical because I think a seasoned IG would be more careful before they throw up a big number like that. I have not seen the breakdowns. I will tell you the latest report in support of this big number is we've seen the reports now on derivatives from March for the big bank holding companies. And what it shows is scary because it shows that, you remember, we gave Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley the right to be essentially a bank and use the federal guarantee. They can use the federal guarantee to borrow money. So if you could use the federal guarantee to borrow money, our credit cards would charge 2%. Okay, so they can borrow money very cheaply. Well, if you look at the derivatives reports from March 31st for the bank holding companies, it indicates to me that they're using FDIC insurance. They're using our credit to finance growth in their derivatives portfolio. So what we're watching is the federal credit being used to support exploding derivatives, which is, of course, deeply concerning.
Still a long way to dig our way out, Catherine. Catherine's websites, you can find them on our Twitter feed at twitter.com/coasttocoastam, financial permaculture, solari.com. Thanks, Catherine. A UK primary school has been accused of terrifying pupils after pretending a teacher had been abducted by aliens. The stunt by the junior high school was intended to promote creative writing. The head, Diana Goss, told pupils an alien craft had landed near the school. The pupils were encouraged to follow a trail of debris before stumbling across the UFO. They even had the cops involved. Police set up a crime scene around the crashed craft and supplied a police constable and a community support officer. They were there for 2 hours to help the children produce witness statements. Pupils were told that the school's learning teacher, Joy Law, who was responsible for special needs, had been abducted. Parents went nuts, condemned the school for terrifying their children, and claimed the teachers had gone over the top in trying to fire their imagination. And the other night, we prayed for rain in Texas. This email in from Charlie, it says, I'm in Houston. Parts of Houston have been receiving good rain now for the last 3 days. Looks like San Antonio and Austin, they're going to get it as well. Keep it up. Well, we'll try. Back in a moment as we talk about the moon and astronauts on Coast to Coast AM. Fascinating hour for you now. We're going to give you some behind-the-scene tidbits of astronauts. Tim Miller created and has been the chairman of the board of the Nashville-based Flat Signed Press. Since 1999, he worked for the United States Congress in Washington, D.C. during the Carter administration, was a White House correspondent in the 1970s. Tim has also worked closely with many of the Apollo astronauts and was privy to many of their amazing stories. And here he is on Coast to Coast. Tim, how are you?
I'm great, George. How are you?
Good to have you with us. What a momentous time. See, even though it's 40 years, it feels like it was yesterday, doesn't it?
It really does, and coincidentally, with the passing of Walter Cronkite, those vivid images of him and Wally Schirra sitting behind the desk as our Americans were landing on the moon, truly incredible.
Indeed, indeed. Tell me about this inner circle you made your way into with the astronauts.
Well, I was very fortunate, and I've been fortunate much or most of my life. It started with Wally Schirra. He called me up after I sent him a letter more than 10 years ago, and he turned out to be the most down-to-earth, kindest guy you'd ever want to meet. And through him, I met 8 or 9 other astronauts, Alan Bean, Michael Collins, Gordon Cooper, Richard Gordon, James Lovell, John Glenn, all these guys autographed books for me. And that's my trade. I procure and sell autographed books, and these American heroes are one of my specialties.
How much time, Tim, did you have to chat with them?
Oh, Wally and I chatted dozens, if not more, times for hours. The only person that I've mentioned who I have not gotten to meet or talk to or work with direct is Neil Armstrong. And Neil and I have been emailing back and forth, but he's a very reclusive individual. And with him, the only contact I've had is email, but even that's a privilege. He was introduced to me by Wally, as were many of the other astronauts, and probably have spent more time with Buzz Aldrin than any of the others, because Buzz and I worked together on 2 books that I published with him.
Buzz is a fireball. I was on Larry King's show with him many, many months ago, and he's a very determined guy. And I had asked him quietly how he felt about the people who were running around saying that they never went to the moon, and that gets to him, Tim. He doesn't like that one.
I'm surprised he didn't slug you.
No, he wouldn't. I was on the panel with him.
Well, lucky for me.
No, had I had a Bible and tried to get him to swear on it, then that would have been different.
Obviously, you know the story of where he literally did slug a guy for saying such a thing as that.
Absolutely. But, I saw the 3 astronauts standing with President Barack Obama today. And, when you talk about how quickly 40 years goes by, I'm looking at these great American heroes, truly great American heroes, and I'm saying, gosh, they're old. They look like my dad almost, and it was just amazing to just put that in perspective, that they were the first human beings on the moon.
And it's really a strange coincidence. All 3 are 70 years old. They were all 30 years old at the time they went to the moon, and that's totally by coincidence. But frankly, I hope I'll look as good as Buzz when I'm 70. He's great shape, he is.
Yes, he is. Indeed he is, Tim. Stay with us because we're going to come back and take some phone calls with you just about your working relationship with the astronauts. And Also, I've got to ask you that question when we come back. Did you ever talk to them about any UFO sightings or anything like that? So many people have wanted that opportunity to ask them. I know I've chatted with Edgar Mitchell about that, Apollo 14 astronaut. Let's get your take when we come back, and we'll open up the phone lines just to get your questions with Tim Miller or just your stories about the moon landing, if you remember where you were in 1969. Well, I was with my father watching the moon landing on our black and white television set. Dad was 47, and I was 19. And it seems like a long time ago. And welcome back to Coast War with publisher Tim Miller. Tim, I remember back in my days, every kid wanted to be an astronaut. Everybody did during those days. You remember that?
I do. I, too, wanted to be president of the United States or an astronaut. One of the two.
We just all loved it. When they picked the Apollo 11 astronauts and they finally landed on the moon, Aldrin and Armstrong, and Armstrong being the first one down the chute and the ladder, did they do that? Did they pick him because he was a civilian?
No, they picked him because of PR reasons. Buzz Aldrin, by far, was the more intellectual, more educated type. But Neil Armstrong was the perfect public relations guy. He was a small town, good-looking, mild-mannered, sophisticated, but still down-to-earth kind of guy. And everything else being equal, he was picked by NASA because he was going to be the one that represented NASA better. Now, that might hurt Buzz Aldrin's feelings if he's listening, but that's just the truth.
Did the other astronauts ever confide with you in terms of why Neil really didn't become a public speaker with regards to this issue? I've been told he was just shy, but is that the case?
Well, as I just mentioned, he really is a shy person, and that's certainly part of it. But he has conducted public speaking events, not on a regular basis, but for a very, very large fee. He has conducted, I would say, one or two a year in the last 40 years. After coming back from the moon, he actually entered the business world and became on the boards of many corporations. And unlike most of the astronauts, Neil immediately became financially successful. Most of the astronauts, after leaving NASA and living on their small retirement income, did work with me to supplement their income by selling their autographs. And they would go to both large and small shows to meet with the general public and be paid anywhere from $100 to, in the case of Buzz Aldrin, he charges $300 for an autograph. And that's how these guys made money after their careers had ended. But Neil does, he's still available out there for a fee. I think it's $100,000 or so.
Wow, but $300 in autograph, that was his charge. And then I guess he gets it, huh?
He certainly does. Now, in the case of Neil Armstrong, his autograph goes for over $1,000 because he doesn't do many public events, and he is reclusive. In the case of Buzz Aldrin and most of the other astronauts, they're just the opposite. They're very outgoing, and they enjoy meeting the public to some degree. Neil doesn't really like meeting with the public, and I talked with him for years about working together and publishing an autographed leather-bound book to match Buzz Aldrin's and the other books that I published. And at one time he said yes, with some restrictions. And then by the time I had arranged the financing, he changed his mind, which is one of the great regrets of my life.
Oh, absolutely.
But autographs are investments, whether it be, you know, President Obama now or Abraham Lincoln hundreds of years ago. There is it's over a billion-dollar industry.
Wow.
just just in the United States.
That's amazing, Tim. Now, did you chat with them at all about UFO experiences or anything like that? Because we've heard these incredible stories.
Yes, and actually, you know, I had no way of knowing that Dr. Mitchell was going to be on the show before me, but he is probably the most prominent of the astronauts who has given more detail of what he saw in regards to UFOs, but also Buzz Aldrin, more than on one occasion, saw UFOs both going to and coming back from the moon, and we talked about that. In fact, we chatted earlier about the guy he slugged for saying that Buzz never went to the moon. When Buzz and I first met, he asked where I was from, and I said Nashville, Tennessee. And coincidentally, that guy he slugged, who had been following him around for years, happened to be from Nashville, Tennessee. And he immediately asked me if I had any connection to the guy, and you could tell his face was red and he got angry until I told him I had never even heard of the incident until Buzz told me about it. But back to the UFOs.
And the guy who was on Coast to Coast a couple times, Bart Sobrell.
I didn't know.
Yeah, and by the way, with Edgar, Edgar claims he never saw a UFO, but he's been told of its and their existence by higher-ups. Gordon Cooper, of course, the late Gordon Cooper, he saw some.
Well, as did Frank Borman, James Lovell, and Buzz Aldrin saw UFOs on more than one occasion. But as far as Edgar Mitchell, you know, we talked earlier about the coincidence of all three of the Apollo 11 astronauts being 30. And I think that these small coincidences, these are like small miracles, a game played by God, I say. It's a coincidence that Edgar grew up in Roswell, New Mexico. And what Edgar has publicly talked about is having talked to many people
yes.
who lived in Roswell at the time, who witnessed, personally witnessed, the aircraft that crashed, and it was not the same aircraft that two or three days later the U.S. government took pictures and showed the public. And Edgar Mitchell believes that not only in UFOs, but he also believes that that was a crash of a UFO.
Let's take some calls, Tim, while we've got some time. Brenda, truck driving around in Maryland, first-time caller. Hi, Brenda, go ahead.
It is such a joy to speak with you. I listen to you every night.
Thank you, Brenda.
Great show. But in 1958 or 59, my dad was in the Navy, and he was stationed in Providence, Rhode Island. And from there, we moved to California, and this other family that lived across the street was transferred there also. Well, one day, the mother came screaming across the street. My dad just happened to be in from sea duty. He took off behind her, and this child was standing in the hall, had stuck his hand in a heater grate. And he's standing there bleeding when my dad grabs a towel, wraps the kid's hand up, and he takes a dime out of his pocket and takes two big screws loose, lifts the heater grate off, picks up the end of this child's finger, put it in his handkerchief, put it in his shirt pocket, and away they go to the base hospital. Well, the doctor sewed the finger back on, and I think she had to go back and have him check it, you know, every day for
yeah.
a while. Well, it took, and everything was great. That child probably would not have been an astronaut had he not had all 10 digits. It was Kenny Bowersox.
Oh, my.
And his mom and my mom still stay in contact. His mom lives in Indiana. Both of our fathers have since passed away. I think it's been about, probably 20 years since I've seen Kenny. He came by the house when I lived in Clinton, Mississippi. I live in Brandon now, but he had a brother that is a heart surgeon, one of the best in the country. And he has another brother who's into mechanics, and he had a sister that was born in California. So it's just amazing what a small world we live in.
That is.
And my mom and dad, before my dad passed away, got to go down. They invited him down to Nassau to see him take off on Kenny's last shuttle.
Oh, that's something.
I believe he's retired now from the Nassau, but he's teaching.
He did a lot of shuttle flights
to the Hubble Space Telescope at the time.
Right.
During his day, right. And turned out to be a very accomplished pilot.
And another neighbor of ours in Clinton, Mississippi, Duck, D-U-C-K was their last name, Jimmy Duck. He was one of the first men that dove in to retrieve one of the first shuttles that came back in the ocean.
That's a great story. Thanks, Brenda. We get them all here, Tim.
Yes, sir. I could tell. I was interested in that story.
Let's go next to Santa Monica, California. John, you're up with us. Hey, John, how are you?
Hi, George. Good to talk to you. By the way, I want to tell you what a big fan I am.
Thank you.
Great, great show. I met you at the Conscious Life Expo, by the way.
Ah, okay.
The author of The Ascendancy, John Weisskopf.
Sure.
Yeah, listen, it's a really interesting story. I grew up in Maryland, and I went to the University of Maryland, and I worked in the physics department. Now, I don't know if your guest knows about the astronauts in translunar flight, the Apollo 11 crew. If he had talked to them or not, you know, I'd be curious to know. But I was a student there. I think I was, 69, and I graduated in 71. But I'd been working at the physics department for 18 months. And they had an idea. It was a last-minute idea. They built a lunar reflector, I think, with University of Texas that is still working today, and it measures the distance from the Earth to the Moon. And what happened is that because I worked in the shipping department, and I didn't have graduate studies, they asked me, there were three very small handheld argon laser filters, and they asked me to fly them down and deliver them down to Cape Kennedy. My fiance at the time, my ex, Patricia, she was working in space physics, so she paid her own way, but the University of Maryland paid everything for me. They flew me down. I went down on a Sunday, July 13th, and we stayed there in July. I can't remember if it was July 14th or 15th. We delivered the small argon laser. What they were going to do is fire. University of Maryland's specialty was laser technology.
Yeah.
And what they were going to do was fire different laser beams from various observatories around the globe at the capsule when it was in translunar flight going towards the Moon. And they were asking the astronauts to hold these small filters up to filter out all the light but the green wavelength. And the argon laser that they were firing at them was a green wavelength.
Huh.
So they paid a fortune to fly me down there. And each of these filters cost about $2,000 each.
We didn't have FedEx in those days, did we?
No, we didn't. It didn't exist. So I was it.
You were the FedEx courier.
And it was unbelievable. You know, we went down there and, you know, you would think that they would, you know, be staying. They were staying at the Holiday Inn. And we got there at the Holiday Inn, and I got there. It was around 6:25 in the morning, and we missed them by 5 minutes. And we missed them by 5 minutes. They had left before that, and they went out to NASA, and they said, we'll just deliver them. They're waiting for them, and we'll give them as soon as we see them. And I, you know, wanted to stay and barter and stuff, but, you know, I said, no, this is too important. So we gave it to them, and then we stayed for 2 days, and it was an incredible experience, though. Do you know anything about that experiment? Had you heard anything about it, or?
I haven't, Tim. How about you?
No, I can't say that I have, but I can say that this gentleman is part of the American space program.
He
so
sure
congratulations.
Is. Absolutely, it is truly remarkable how these little facets. Just these last two calls that we've had. How it's competitive true. Were the astronauts?
Well, some of the astronauts were extremely competitive, and they also had cliques. Wally was the one guy that I can think of who everybody loved. And Wally, that's why I was so fortunate that he was the first contact I made, and then to get to know all of the other astronauts via him, because he was the end to all the cliques. Buzz Aldrin has his own clique, and it has one member, and that's Buzz Aldrin. But then Neil Armstrong, everyone certainly loves Neil Armstrong, but not even the astronauts got to see Neil that much. I remember talking once with Wally about introducing me to Neil, and he and Neil talking about the book that I wanted to publish, and the whole point of the book was to have him autograph 1,000 copies or so. And even with Wally's recommendation, I think that's why Neil originally said yes. But Neil does not like the idea that people profit from his autograph. He wants people to have his autograph in limited numbers, family, friends, close associates. But if he, like Buzz Aldrin, signed a lot, thousands and thousands, then that diminished the value of his autograph. That was his logic. But what really fascinated me were these clicks. And Buzz got off on the wrong foot from the very beginning. I don't know if you know this story. You probably do. But he, without getting prior permission, he actually took coins and other tiny pieces or relics to the moon.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I heard that.
And it's fascinating. He did that in order to bring them back and sell them.
Yeah.
And Buzz became on the outside, let's say, being kind in that choice of words from that day forward. And then just a few years later, of course, Buzz checked himself into a rehabilitation center. And as far as I know, in talking to the other guys, Buzz never really became part of their clique. He was the most commercial of all the astronauts, and Neil is on the other extreme, and then the rest of them were in the middle. But most of these guys were just really regular, all-American guys, and they were in the right program at the right time. This all started with the pilots from World War II, and then the individual pilots who wanted to go on to become part of the space program applied and then had to pass an sundry of tests just to be considered. So it all goes back to World War II, and then Wally was the only member of all three of the recent space programs, Gemini, Apollo, and the space shuttle, and that's why he knew more than more of the individuals, I think, because he worked in all three programs.
Well, they all had the right stuff, Tim, didn't they?
That's exactly the title, Chuck Yeager. He was one of one of the people who hung around the astronauts and befriended them, and he was like one of the first. He never went to the moon, but Chuck Yeager was really beloved, and he was seen as a hero amongst these heroes.
Why didn't they pick Yeager for a space flight?
That I don't know. I'm sure Yeager would have loved to do it. Without getting in front of a computer and checking, I would say that either Yeager failed some part of the physical test, or for some other reason had some small physical impairment. I mean, these people had to be physically perfect. You know the story.
And he's still alive, too. He's
yeah. He is
86.
So he's no older than Edgar Mitchell, who is about 86 himself. I think he was born in 1930. That makes him 79. So why he was picked, what I was going to say is I know that, you know, astronauts were cut from the program because they had a cold or at least scrubbed from that particular mission. Other people were totally rejected because they might have an inner ear problem, some small defect that would not have any life-threatening issue or something that might not even have any impact on their life. And I suspect that's why Chuck was cut, but I don't know for sure.
All right. And a great American brigadier general, I think.
Absolutely.
And did his thing. Tim, what's your website?
Flatsigned.com, FlatSigned, and these guys that we've been talking about were all kind enough to autograph books, and I invite your listeners to go to the website and check it out. Buzz Aldrin, as I said, charges $300 for his autograph, but his autograph leather-bound book on our website is only $150.
That's better than the autograph. Thanks, Tim. I'll be back in a moment with Robert Zimmerman, Bob Zimmerman, as we talk about all things space on Coast to Coast AM.